I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1990, the album, The Day the Laughter Died, the artist, Andrew Dice Clay, and my guest, Greg Turkington. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And so, at first I was shocked that you picked it, knowing your work, but then it took me 2 seconds to realize that maybe I shouldn't be. So I grew up not liking Dice. And I still have trouble with it because I'm a little sensitive baby sometimes, right? So that's where I'm coming from a completely separated. So I want to know what it meant to you to hear it at the time.
Well, you know, it wasn't so much the offensiveness of what he's saying that was appealing to it. It was more that, to me, when that record came out, it was completely like any other comedy record I'd heard, in that it was total character comedy. I never believed for a second that he was advocating anything that he says on the record.
Yeah.
And I knew that he was successful with his character comedy, and that it was, you know, I don't know, it was attracting a certain sort of idiot audience that maybe he was enjoying having. But I also knew from listening to him that, I mean, all the clues were there in everything that he said. That like, he doesn't buy this. This is like Fred Flintstone. You know what I mean? This is like preposterous.
Yeah.
And why he was targeted for doing this when so many other people in comedy weren't, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know why everybody took it so seriously, because I thought, like, everything he's saying is completely absurd.
Yeah.
This is not his point of view. And so this record was really interesting because it was taking that stuff and it was almost deconstructing it. And, you know, here he does his double album that doesn't... I mean, it has some material on it, but it's kind of this weird, just goading this tiny crowd. I mean, he picked a tiny crowd, and he's just kind of alienating them all the way through. And it's probably 2/3 or 3/4 of the record anybody else would cut off of their record.
Absolutely.
And he's leaving it all there.
Everything.
But then there's so much really heavy and really smart stuff going on this record. And also... for somebody who is so committed to this character to the point that it was destroying his career, he actually flat out says on this record that it's a character.
Yeah. Yeah.
He explicitly says this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And what a strange place to do it, you know, on a record that's going to be considered unlistenable by most people, you know?
Right.
But he flat out says, oh, yeah, everything I'm saying on this record is true. It's all the truth. And so I thought it was really great and so different than any other record, especially at that time. You know, I mean, you're talking about like a Tony Clifton type of situation, but not being taken that way.
Right.
Instead of people heralding him as like total commitment to this character. Instead, it's like, oh, this guy's misogynist and sexist, and like, yeah, well, yeah, the character is,
of course, yeah.
So, I don't know. I just appreciated that it showed that there's just so many different levels that in which you can make a record, and it doesn't have to just be. I mean, the other comedy record I really liked was the Albert Brooks "A Star Is Bought," which to me that was more the type of comedy record I liked, where it was scripted out and it wasn't just somebody rolling tape in a room.
Yeah,
but to roll tape in this room that Dice rolled tape in with this shitty crowd, and not to sweeten the tracks with anything,
right?
So bold, and the offensiveness, I think people it was kind of overdone, because if you listen to Eddie Murphy records or anybody from that era, it's just as offensive, really. I don't know why he was taking all the heat for it. It's just that he wouldn't back down, he wouldn't wink, and to me, doing like all the Neil Hamburger records and things, I mean, for years and years I wouldn't talk about these things, and I wanted the packaging not to look like a smart guy who is making a record as a character, but to look like this is a real entity, you know?
Yeah.
And I think this record kind of was an eye-opener in terms of showing how you could have that kind of commitment to something.
And I do you you mentioned Eddie Murphy, and that's a really good comparison, because I feel like it's a difference between character and personality, whereas I'm not going to assume that Eddie Murphy's necessarily is homophobic or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as he is, but he's definitely exaggerating something that seems to come from him, whereas Dice, I don't know that we'll ever know who the real guy is deep down, which is fine, I guess, but like, he really committed the fuck out of that character.
He really, really did, and I don't know. It's like, he could say all these horrible things and you could take it seriously, but then when he does 5 minutes about how he saves money by squirting one brand of shampoo onto the floor and filling the bottle with another shampoo brand to save $2, it's like, oh, come on. You really going to take anything this guy is saying seriously?
Right, you know?
I don't know. I mean, Dice is good friends with my friend Tom Green, and and Tom sometimes had parties over there and invited me, and I'm always really nervous because I really like to meet Dice, you know. I had a friend who actually wrote a review of this record in 1990 for Goldmine, the Record Collectors magazine. I had another friend who wrote a review, and I think ours were the only two good reviews that the record got, really.
That's insane.
And my friend wrote it for his college newspaper, this guy Mark Prindle, who's got an incredible website where he reviews records, or did review records. So he wrote this review of The Day the Laughter Died, saying, what's the problem here? This is like great performance art.
Yeah.
You know? And it was a pretty extensive review, and he really explained what he thought the record was about. And he went home for Christmas or for Thanksgiving, and the phone rang at his parents' house, and it was Dice.
Jesus.
And Dice like tracked him down and called him up on Thanksgiving to thank him and to say like, you're the only guy that got this.
Oh my
like,
God.
Thank you. You understand what I was trying to do.
Wow.
And talked to him for quite a while on the phone, and it just was really appreciative.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just like, people don't get it. People don't get this.
This is, well, I mean, you picking this is what's been making me think all day, and just, I grew up a super sensitive kid. Not going to have, at 10 years old when this comes out, I'm not going to have the sense to understand what the fuck is going on. But to realize at 36 that I probably carried that lack of understanding of Dice for way too long is very frustrating to me. I mean, did I assume it was really the guy? No, but I assumed it was more the guy, I think, than this album makes clear.
Right.
It isn't, you know? And that's...
It's tough because it's an abrasive character.
Sure. And if,
you know, I consider myself pretty sensitive, and I guess that Dice is, I would guess that he was a sensitive guy to make a record like this. You know what I mean? I mean, you look at Don Rickles, who's also known for this sort of whatever hate comedy or whatever. And, you know, he had the sense to, at the end of an hour's worth of horrible, horrible things to come out and give this kind of kumbaya type of little speech, you know, about, you know, we're all people and this sort of thing.
Right.
And that's probably the only way you could do a show like that, you know?
True.
And Dice didn't do that. And, you know, his career kind of got ruined.
You know? Yeah.
I think he's doing okay now. But, it was kind of... I thought it was kind of ugly, some of the things that people were saying. And the weird thing was, is one of my best friends when this record came out, this woman was like a total avowed feminist. And she loves this record, and it was just like her favorite comedy record of all time, and she was really always defending this record to people and saying, you don't get it, like this guy is on the right track, like, you know. So I don't know, but you know, that said, I totally get it if someone puts this on and says, I've got to get away from this record. Because you know, there's some harsh moments. I also think it's a really it's a pioneering record in the field of crowd work, you know.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is just him being willing to roll the dice with whatever happens with who he talks to.
How many people walk out? There are a few people that walk out and you hear them.
You hear them.
Nothing's chopped from that. It's insane to me.
It's insane. And I think a record that meant a lot to me also in the same way was the Phil Oakes record called Gunfight at Carnegie Hall.
And I
Phil
have not Oakes heard was, this. Okay.
He was a folk singer who became kind of a pop singer and had issues with manic depression. A very, like, to me, probably my biggest idol over my life was Phil Oakes, you know. And this record, which was the last record he made, was recorded at Carnegie Hall. It's called Gunfight at Carnegie Hall. And it was a show that he did there where the audience came expecting him to do his songs from his catalog that were essentially like folk protest songs.
Okay.
These types of songs. And instead, he came out with a gold suit that he had Nudie the Tailor make and did Elvis and Buddy Holly and Merle Haggard covers.
Holy shit.
While presenting these theories that the only hope for revolution was if you could convince somebody, convince somebody to come up with an act that was a combination of Elvis Presley and Che Guevara, you know.
Oh my God.
And so the audience just starts booing really early on, and he's doing the Buddy Holly medley, and people are just booing and booing, and he's like, hold on, you know, let me explain. And he's trying to talk, but I mean, and that's why the record came out as Gunfight at Carnegie Hall. Yeah. And you know, A&M Records, that was his label, they didn't want to release this record because they're like, this is a nightmare. This is destructive to your career.
Yeah.
And he insisted that they release it. So they worked out a compromise where it came out on A&M Records of Canada, in Canada only.
Holy
as
shit.
A test market.
Okay.
And of course the record failed, and that was the last anyone heard of it. But that was a record that when I was, you know, 14, 15, I was obsessed with this record because I'd never heard booing on a record. I'd never heard things go wrong in this way. And so, you know, years later with this Dice record, I was kind of fascinated that I thought it was direct lineage. There's direct lineage between that and this.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff really influenced me just in terms of being unafraid by audience reaction and just going for it. If you've got a certain mood or something that you're trying to put out there, that you just got to do it and not worry.
God,
and even embrace it like these guys did with these two records, you know. And these are great records. They're so much more powerful than other records to me, because it's just so bold.
It's so genuinely live too. I mean, like, I have plenty of live albums, but these live albums, let's go back to Eddie Murphy. I know that those are cut up over multiple nights. I feel like the only other, and I mean, this is the low end of things, but like, I'm looking at the Button Down Minded Bob Newhart, only different because it's his first time performing on stage ever. But then this shit is legitimately live. Like, the whole point is you want a unique experience. There's no other night that went like this 90 minutes went.
I mean, I think on the record, I can't remember, I didn't look at it, but I think it might give two dates, two consecutive dates, but I feel like it wasn't that they were putting together the best moments. Sure. They were stretching it out to make it even longer and more torturous than it was by putting the two sets together. I don't know.
It could be, right?
I don't know, that makes sense. You know, Rick Rubin produced this record. And, you know, this is a guy who, you know, I couldn't stand. I mean, I'd rather have bamboo shoots under my nails and listen to the Red Hot Chili Peppers and some of the things that he's done. But he was a big, big fan of Flipper, which is like one of my all-time favorite musical groups, and I knew these guys, and it's just such a big influence. They were another fuck you audience type of performers. They were a punk rock band in the late 70s and early 80s, and they, as the songs got faster and faster and shorter and shorter, their songs got longer and slower. So, you know, they'd be on these bills with Black Flag and the Dead Kennedys or whatever, and they'd do, over the course of an hour, they'd do like four or five songs that each lasted like 12, 15 minutes. They were really bass heavy, repetitious, but with these really esoteric, really brilliant lyrics. And they would just take these bass riffs and just beat them into the ground, and It was really something. And they were Rick Rubin's all-time favorite group. And he had his own group called Hoes, which I saw in San Francisco around 1982 or 83. And they were just a total ripoff of Flipper.
Really?
Like the bass sound, everything about it. It was like ridiculous. And that's everyone knew this. And that's how obsessed Rick Rubin was. So then later, when he had his own record label, he goes and buys up Flipper's entire catalog and reissues it. And so him producing this Dice record to me also made a lot of sense, because it has the same kind of relentless quality where it's like, yeah, you know, 95% of the people here, 95% of the people listening are going to hate this, but the 5% that like it, it's going to be the best thing they ever heard. And it's totally going to tap into what they're looking for. And so I think he had a lot to do with letting this thing out there the way that it was.
The little bit I read was, that he specifically gave that guidance, and I guess it was drop-ins. He was doing drop-ins at Dangerfields with an audience that was not expecting to see, not expecting to have pussy eating and ass eating thrown in their face, like, mm-hmm. within the first, 15 minutes of the fucking album.
And that's, those topics are actually, that's the funny thing about it, is the more disgusting, repulsive things that he says are actually kind of the easiest to take.
Yeah.
It's when he says "our back" for 15 minutes straight or whatever, mm-hmm. that's when you're actually like, what is this? I can't take this.
Right.
Go back to the ass eating.
It's relentless.
It is.
And I don't, that takes balls.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you absorb this album? Like, did it have a direct influence in terms of performance, or is it just always in the back of your mind, that's the kind of shit I'd like to do? Or did there's something you feel like you could have pulled from?
I mean, it's weird. I think the stuff that influenced me, it's like, I know what it is, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of different things that all piece together. I mean, it's like that with a lot of folks, but it's just tiny bits from this and that. This had a direct influence. Particularly, there was an album I made, a Neil Hamburger record called Left for Dead in Malaysia, mm-hmm. the premise of which is that Neil Hamburger is performing in Malaysia to an audience that doesn't speak English. And once he figures that out, he just gives up on the material and just kind of rambles and wallows in self-pity, because it doesn't matter what he does. They can't understand it anyway.
Yeah.
He just has to talk for half an hour in this forum. And I think that record is pretty influenced by this Dice record. Mm-hmm. Maybe it wouldn't be that obvious if you listen to it, but I was definitely thinking about this record when I was making that one.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And, with that one, as with the first almost 10 years of Neil Hamburger, there was no real Neil Hamburger. They were strictly recording projects.
That's what I figured. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that record, there was no live show in Malaysia. However, because I wanted it to be authentic,
mm-hmm.
I went to Malaysia to make the record, and I recorded it in Malaysia. It's just, it wasn't a real show. I recorded it in my hotel room, and then I went around to bars in Malaysia and recorded sounds of people talking and ambient sound. Jesus, and then I kind Christ. Of like sifted through and pieced that all together to make it sound like a real show, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's a thing on there where somebody turns on the jukebox in the bar because they're sick of hearing Neil Hamburger mm-hmm. go on. And you hear that distorted out of one channel of your stereo
mm-hmm.
as if it's a jukebox in the corner of the room. And, I went to record store in Malaysia and was just asking questions about old Malaysian pop, trying to find a good...
Holy shit.
Record, something that would be coming out of the jukebox, So I did this work to make it authentic, but mm-hmm. of course it wasn't. And I specifically had only one joke on the record, and mm-hmm. the rest of it really is just self-pity. With the Dice record, I listened to it again, and there's more material on that than I remembered. And, mm-hmm. Sometimes you read reviews of The Day the Laughter Died that are like, there's no jokes at all, but there are jokes.
Yeah, no.
It's just, they're not the point of the show.
Sure.
And there's very few of them.
Yeah.
Did you listen to it today?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it tough going for you?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I definitely, there are times I definitely flip for it. I will admit that. Out of 90 minutes, I had to flip. I just wonder, not knowing enough about him, I don't, and this is all going to be conjecture on both our parts, why the fuck he agreed to do this? What do you think it was that his career was flagging and it was just let's try it, let's go off of what this producer recommends, who, by the way, Rick Rubin was still super young at the time,
mm-hmm.
very young. So
yeah,
what the fuck it says let's do this. I mean, it's in, I think in retrospect, you're right, it makes sense in terms of artistically it makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't commercially it doesn't
no
doesn't. So
no, and it's a double album.
That's expensive as fuck.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe, I can only speculate, mm-hmm. but maybe he just wanted to make some art,
Yeah.
And maybe, I think it could be frightening to have some of the fan base building up that he was getting and then be accused of these types of things.
Sure.
When it's like, nobody wants to be called a racist. Nobody wants to be called these things if that's not what you are, And I don't know, perhaps it was just an attempt to... confront some of this, but using a strange method to do mm-hmm. so, if that was the case.
Yeah, because I mean, there's no way. I mean, let's say it had picked up. he's not going to go on Letterman. Let's say that the album had done well. He's not going to go on Letterman and suddenly be, you know, relaxed, calm, not doing, oh, Dice. Like, he's going to be Dice again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, selling this fucking record that won't make any sense when people buy it. So, yeah.
Yeah, the average record buyer is not going to sit through this.
Oh, yeah.
And also, his last record, and the previous one, I think was recorded at Madison Square Garden.
Oh,
I
right.
mean, and
yeah,
it's
yeah,
just
yeah.
like... Well, you listen to that after this, and it's crazy. Mm-hmm. Just the loud, roaring applause and just yeah. the ability to work with the audience, you know? It's like, yeah. all right, you want this? Here you go. Mm-hmm. You want that? Here we have it. You know, yeah. and this is the opposite. It's like these people are calling out for the nursery rhymes, and he's giving these kind of aborted versions of them, and, you know?
Well, I get so many people on the show who, well, I don't want to say so many. I don't want to say 50-50. I haven't written the shit down. But mm-hmm. there are, again, I'm going to say two types of comedians, also not true. But people who are very much just go for the laugh. Whatever makes people laugh is, but I personally like comedic art. So I personally like when people take chances and like when people try and say something,
mm-hmm.
which you don't have to necessarily. Because I don't know that he's directly saying something with this. I feel like the whole 90 minutes as
like
a whole
is.
Says something.
Yeah, yeah.
But not individually, not in pieces. Although, maybe not, maybe so, though.
There's
I mean,
some moments.
There's a lot about, you know, about those things he's being accused of being.
But I think something I got from this record that definitely guided the initial Neil Hamburger stuff, and like I say, the Neil Hamburger wasn't a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was strictly a recording thing for years. But,
yeah.
But just the importance of... creating a mood, like a total mood mm-hmm. that you're immersed in 100% over just having jokes. You
yeah.
know? I mean, it might be a strange comparison, but that's why I think Disneyland is nicer to go to than Magic Mountain, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is that like you go into any of those rides or whatever and every detail is taken care of
sure.
so that, you know, you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the Caribbean with these pirates or
right,
whatever.
Right.
And that goes down to waiting in line for the ride. You know, the mm-hmm. the lines are interesting.
Sure.
They keep you occupied. You know, whereas like you go to Magic Mountain and it's just, how can we cram more people into this tiny space and
mm-hmm.
have them go around in circles until they get to the ride? And
how much soda
joyless.
Can I drink before I puke? Like
it's,
that's very much what it is.
Yeah.
Ugh.
No joy to it. So I don't know. I think that he's really like this record has more of a mood than most records you're ever going to hear.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And definitely when you start adding applause and things to records, I think you really lose any ability to relate to it as a listener.
Sure.
At least I find that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Are you able to pick out? Do you have an ear for canned laughter, do you think, at this point?
I do, because especially from doing stand-up, you know, when you're building, and actually Comedy Central is really guilty of this with their specials,
yeah.
but when you're building a joke, you know, unless you have a joke that's 10 seconds long, you know, sometimes you gotta provide a lot of information because you're working for the payoff. And I know, like, when you're watching Comedy Central specials, they don't want to have 45 seconds or a minute where there's no laughing going
yeah,
on.
Right, right.
And so they'll just be... They just kind of wait for the comedian to pause for a second
mm-hmm.
in what they're saying, and then they cut to somebody laughing,
uh-huh.
and they add that, and it's like, this would never happen.
Right.
No one would laugh right now.
Right. Or as hard as they are, it's just, yeah.
It sucks. It sucks, because then the whole thing becomes unreal and,
mm-hmm.
and unwatchable, if you ask me.
Yeah.
You just got to let it be. Just let these things breathe, and then the final laughter is going to be so much more powerful.
Sure.
I was watching one of these the other day. I'm not even going to name whose special it was, but I couldn't believe how they wouldn't let them go 3 seconds without having to have some snickering
oh.
added. Or it's like, I know nobody's laughing unless they're being tickled. They're
of
not
course.
Being they're not laughing like this, because laughing is, you know, it's kind of involuntary, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I don't know. I think that some of the records that over the years suffer from that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts the record for sure.
That absolutely makes sense. Do you think this is something that this completely out of left field, but the idea of Dice's persona sticking more as who he is to people, do you think that could it all be contributed to the fact that he very much had a look and was very imposing? I think he's a very handsome guy, but that actually makes me afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
The more handsome you are, like, I think I've met John Hamm, very nice guy, but he's scary to me to look at. So it's like, I don't
and
know.
If they're tall too.
Like, 100%. It's just imposing. And I wonder if that, I don't know if that affects it at all, but I mean, you know, we can compare it to Neil Hamburger. I'm not scared of that character because of his comb over. His the comb over alone, because it's something I could unfortunately have to do myself. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, I mean, that could be definitely tall and handsome.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they, I don't know why. I mean, I know Saturday Night Live was after Dice. Like, mm-hmm. they didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that set the tone for all
that's
the backlash.
That also could be too, yeah.
You know, because that's a powerful entity right there.
Mm-hmm.
I really think if you don't let people in, if you don't include them in what you're doing, that people don't like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've found that definitely with the Neil Hamburger stuff. And, you know, my unwillingness to do interviews about it, I think, I mean, it's fine, but I think it hurt it in a way that I'm fine with.
Sure.
But,
sure.
You know, it's because they don't, people don't want to believe that this is real. They want to think there's some cool guy that's doing this, that's letting you in on it.
Sure.
And that's just the truth, you know? And it comes to the whole thing that, you know, a lot of comedians believe that it's more important to be likable than to be funny. You know?
Yeah.
It's the same problem, you know?
Right.
I think that this Dice record is funniest sometimes when it's not being funny, because it's a slow burn laugh that I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you believe this? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And, you know, going back to the Disneyland thing, I mean, it's like when you're in the Pirates of the Caribbean, I mean, it only goes down a couple of little dips.
Yep.
Who cares about those? It's more just in the middle of it where you're just kind of sitting there looking around 100%. In awe of the whole thing. That's how I feel about that record.
That's
you know?
A really good point. Yeah.
There's definitely some moments on that are really funny, like the you know, the shampoo thing and a couple of things where he goes off on some of the audience members. You know, it's incredible, but I think some of the parts where I'm feeling giddiest inside are just silence.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, he's soaking those up so well. I mean, I'll give him that. Like, the few times, I feel like the few times that I, again, the few times that I laughed or smiled
mm-hmm.
were either when he is giving up the ghost, just completely like, come the fuck on.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the times where I did enjoy was where he's, the beginning, the very opening of it, he does the lighting of the cigarette thing, but the fucking gap between puffs into the microphone is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, this is what you're here for. Let's see. Because he probably got a big intro. And then that's what he does. And I don't know. I feel like that's, I don't know. The art of that character is within that full minute that he takes to start talking or however long.
So good. Yeah. I mean, you feel like this is somebody at the peak of their powers, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. this is what they choose to do with it.
Yeah. It's ballsy.
And I don't know if you heard the second one. There's a Day the Laughter Died Part 2.
I have not. I only found out that existed today.
I mean, it's brutal.
Yeah.
It's very different than this.
Really? Okay.
It's very different. It's just, he's just really angry.
Okay.
Just a really angry, he's in a foul mood.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting mad about these targets that really there's no reason to be this mad about Siskel and Ebert or whatever. And it's that kind of thing. I love that record too in a different way, but
yeah.
Those are the two Day the Laughter Died are just the best records that he did. By far.
There is, I feel like, and you could tell me if this is a complete misconception,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to necessarily draw direct comparisons, but I feel like people are going to lump in people like yourself. I know that you work with Tim and Eric, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, but yourself, Tim and Eric, and then let's skip back 30, 40 years and go to Andy Kaufman. There is this assumption that everything you're about and everything you do is about the art of discomfort and creating mm-hmm. discomfort. But what we're talking about today feels like a much more genuine expression of what that is, which is living in these constructed moments, but where to the point where they feel real because you're mm-hmm. living in them for so long. Is that more what it is?
I think so. I mean, if it was just about, I mean, and I talk to Tim about this all the time, like, this isn't anti-comedy that we're into doing.
Right.
We want people to laugh. Like, we're into making people laugh. We just don't take the same route that other people do.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is in those kinds of details and in the kind of a slow burn rather than this kind of like, welcome to my world. Does it reflect your world? Oh, good. Let's laugh.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, nothing against it, but that's what a lot of comedy is that I see is people aren't even laughing at the humor. They're laughing because they recognize what the guy is saying.
Absolutely.
And how it's similar to the way they think. And mm-hmm. that's good enough. That's all they want. Uh-huh. You know,
mm-hmm.
I do like the discomfort, and it's because there's so much art and music and movies and TV that infuriates me. That it's just such shit made mm-hmm. by people with no point of view.
Yeah.
They don't care. They don't care about this stuff. It's strictly either they want to make money or they want to be seen,
mm-hmm.
but they have no interest in producing art.
Right.
No interest. And they have no curiosity about art that's come before or art that, like, they don't care.
Yeah.
It's just about them. You know what I mean? And this stuff is just so fucking infuriating. And so when you go to see a stupid band or a shitty movie or whatever, an awful comedian that has no point of view, and everyone around you is just roaring and having the time of their lives, and you're sitting there seething
mm-hmm.
and feeling like, Jesus Christ, I'm completely alienated from this world. Like, what is this? Why are they, what is this?
Yeah.
There's nothing to laugh at here, you know? Then you're feeling uncomfortable and horrible. So it's nice, I think, with some of this to be able to turn it around so mm-hmm. that you're actually enjoying this kind of thing and everyone else gets to feel the misery.
Yeah.
And, you know, the band Flipper that I was talking about, they had a graffiti that was around San Francisco when they were around. Flipper suffered for their art. Now it's your turn. And, you know, I think there's something to that.
Absolutely.
I think there's something to that because this record isn't for everyone. And definitely the stuff that Tim and Eric do
mm-hmm.
is not for everyone. But, sure. Geez, the people that like it, they don't get that much stuff done for them.
Right, yeah.
And this shit taps into something and it, like, taps deep in them. They're usually people that actually care about aesthetics and mm-hmm. things like that.
Right.
It's not just somebody that's going to go fucking laugh at Beverly Hills Ninja when it's being rerun on Comedy Central.
Right.
And they're totally satisfied with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sorry, but as mad as somebody's going to get at a Neil Hamburger show saying, this isn't funny or whatever, it's not one-tenth as mad as I'm going to get when I'm pumping gas at 76 and some fucking garbage dance tracks are blaring from a speaker above the gas pump. You know, this vocoder shit vocal, I'm going to be a lot madder. I guarantee you.
Yeah.
It's an assault. It's a fucking assault. So, yeah, I mean, maybe there is a bit of that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, geez, you know.
But it couldn't be just about that.
No.
The discomfort. I mean, that's just.
We're trying to make stuff for the people that it's like communication. You want to communicate with the people that are receptive to what you have to say because they need it. Like mm-hmm. when I was a kid growing up, like the stuff that I was into was mostly from people that were dead
mm-hmm.
or that mm-hmm. nobody cared about. And so you'd have to search, I mean, pre-internet, you know, because
sure.
I'm 100 years old, but you'd have to really search to find these books or these records or whatever.
Sure.
And it took years to build up the Phil Oaks catalog
uh-huh.
or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't know. There's a real commitment to this kind of thing. That's all I can say. And, like, I'm so happy when I meet people that talk to me that say, I really love this and I really find this so funny.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like, oh, boy, we just fucking made everyone miserable again. You know, give me
right.
a high five. It's
right.
not that at all. It's
yeah.
just, let's find our people. Let's, you know.
It's got a lot to do, I assume, with, because I'm not a successful entertainer, but it's got to do with, I think, becoming a successful entertainer at the wrong time. And I don't know that, but I don't know if that's necessarily true, but if you had time to build a career, right? And so you become successful while you're trying to make interesting shit. And that interesting shit then becomes who you are. And at the very least, you can be satisfied with, well, I'm successful now, but I can continue making this art because people like my art. Whereas I assume, again, if you get a, let's say you get a writing gig on a shitty TV show right out of college and it's super successful, you're going to continue being shitty and not trying. I mean, that maybe that's the simplest thing in the world. But
no, I think you're absolutely right.
And it makes me at least feel a little bit better that I haven't succeeded. Is that where I'm supposed to gather from
good.
This? Because, I mean, you know, I mean, I tried to make my own audio comedy shit when I was in college, and I think it was better because I didn't have any advantages. I was like, let's keep trying to say something, even if it was garbage.
Well, I mean, I'm definitely nobody that anyone should look to as a way to build a career, but you know, I was working fucking jobs and doing stuff for fun, assuming all the while like nobody would be interested in this shit.
Sure.
So if you're not trying to build a career, which I wasn't, mm-hmm. I think it's easier to actually inadvertently build a career because you're just doing the stuff. I was like, I made so many records. I mean, I must have made, you know, a dozen comedy records, like as Neil Hamburger, but other things as well, mm-hmm. you know, just financing them with my job, pouring ammonia and acetic acid and sulfuric acid into 1 ounce bottles. You know what I mean?
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I would take these records and leave them in thrift stores, assuming like this is going to be funny when somebody takes this home and is like, what the fuck is this thing? And, to my utter bewilderment, you know, enough time went on and I kept doing this stuff that somehow, you know, thanks to definitely people like Tim and Eric mm-hmm. who are like, you know, took me under their wing and are like, let's help this guy out, and other people along like Jack Black and these people that liked what I was doing and sort of gave me more of a forum. But then I get kids that come up and they're like, how can I get this thing going? And I'm like, well, you're 22. I think what you should do is like just try to do as much good work as you can and not worry about the rest. And that's what I was doing, just doing work that I purposely like. Now I realize a lot of people wouldn't like it, but I liked it,
mm-hmm.
and I was trying to make it as good as possible, and it was such an honor when these folks who I respected liked it as well, mm-hmm. you know? It's amazing.
I had no idea how prolific you were with the albums until recently, knowing that you're going to come on the show. I feel like I barely know the character at all now, because after listening to them, first of all, when I listened to, what was the name of your first album? My apologies.
America's Funny Man.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So I throw in a clip and I legitimately thought they had thrown in a clip of a Steve Martin album, because mm-hmm. I had no idea how much you sounded like Steve Martin mm-hmm. originally. When did the voice change?
Well, you know, when I made that record, geez, I was like, I guess I was in my late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing a voice that I believed to be an older man's voice.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to sound like a Midwestern guy in his late 40s, you know. I was not trying to sound like Steve Martin, but I did. You know, honestly, those like first three Steve Martin records, I grew up listening to those records.
Sure.
Like we all did, probably anyone listening to this show.
Yeah.
Probably did. So, you know, it makes sense that it came across that way, but mm-hmm. I was just trying to sound older.
Mm-hmm.
So now that I'm the age that I was supposed to be, it's almost like the age, the voice of Neil Hamburger. If you take the records out of context and listen to one from 93,
mm-hmm.
then listen to one from 2015, you're like, why did he change the voice? But if you put them all in order and mm-hmm. listen to them in order, you'll see that it's just a slow progression.
I was wondering that. Okay.
And it's like a 25-year-old trying to sound like a 50-year-old, then it's like a 45-year-old trying to sound like a 60-year-old or whatever, and so it's just kind of slowly. I mean, it's never as plotted out or contrived.
Of course.
It's more like, let's put on this voice, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I was listening to a lot of when I made those first records, listening to a lot of like bad private pressing loser lounge comedy records, you know.
Yep.
And those guys definitely were listening to Steve Martin.
Sure.
You know, that was kind of the way that he phrased things was the way to do it, I think.
Sure.
And so it would make sense to me that it would come out that way.
The hard part then, of course, is those guys aren't getting it. Like, that's the worst part. That's the worst part of it. God, can you remember any of the ones that you researched? Because, like, you know, I will occasionally try and grab them, you know, a shitty independent press and see if it's any good.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely are they. But
there's one that's, I don't know if it's even right to give the guy's name.
Okay.
This guy, he made this record that just, it blew my mind. I heard it after I'd made America's Funny Man.
Okay.
And on America's Funny Man, I assume when I made that record, and I'd always wanted to make a comedy record as a guy that liked comedy records.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a record label and I was in bands and I was putting out records and stuff. And then Drag City asked me to do a comedy record for them. An album, and mm-hmm. I was like, wow, this is my dream come true. Somebody wants me to make a comedy album. So I put what I felt at the time, I'm like, I'm going to put every idea I've ever had into this thing and really make this just the ultimate final statement on this character. I assumed that was going to be the end of Neil Hamburger because I've like used everything I possibly had, you know? And anyway, it's funny because one of the things on that record was a track called The X-Rated Hot Dog Vendor. And the idea was this is just going to be some kind of weird racy sounding sound effects with applause and laugh track added. And you never really know what's going on. And it's like there's scissor sounds and chopping. And it's like, is his hot dogs getting chopped? Is his penis, like, is he miming? Is he miming someone cutting? Like, who knows? And it was relentless. I mean, it's like a 5-minute track on the album. And then the applause at the end is just overwhelming. Like, this is, you know. So I pieced this thing together, and it was really fun to do, you know, just to get these different sounds and try to steal applause and laughter from different comedy records, and then bring in some people. And I was doing multi-tracking of the applause myself, and trying to make this thing work. So like a year later, I found this private pressing from this Midwestern comic, and he actually had one of his routines that was a sight gag on this record. And it was just as long as the X-Rated Hot Dog Vendor, but he didn't seem to understand why this was a bad thing to put on the record. You know what I mean?
Holy shit.
And then this record has all these titles for tracks. Mm-hmm. What he's done is he's recorded a bunch of shows and then just cut out the one joke. And most of his jokes are like 10 or 15, 20 seconds long. Mm-hmm. So the joke, he tells the joke, and then there's applause, and then there's a fade out.
Oh, my God.
There's a fade out after every joke.
Holy shit.
The audience fades down. Wow. And then he comes back and does another joke. And then it's, and then it fades down quickly. And it's worst way to make an album. Wow. And then it has this sight gag thing. And there's so many things wrong with this album. There's these whole routines that are simply just pandering to pot smokers, you know? Mm-hmm. Kind of like, well, you know, it's fun to eat pizza, but have you ever eaten pizza when you're stoned? And then everybody starts laughing, and then it fades out, you know? Like, what the hell was that?
Oh, my God.
Anyway, it was amazing, because when I heard this record, I'm like, this guy has made America's Funny Man 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
And I was convinced that it was real. Then I played it for some people. I'm like, no, this has to be a joke, like what you were doing.
Yeah.
This is really well done then, because everything about the packaging is depressing. It was the record I wanted to make.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And then I found the guy online, and from reading his website and kind of doing more research, it's real. You know?
Man.
It's real.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my first, like, I would want, like, your first instinct is, oh my God, I can't believe this is real. This is amazing. This person had no self-awareness. You know, this is a Christopher Guest movie come to life. And then you do have that moment of, well, maybe they're not as dumb as they could be as smart as me. They're also into comedy. And then that's that moment of realization. It's just like, fuck. Okay. Well, I gave them, I tried.
And the whole second side is poetry. It's like one side of the comedy and the other side of it is poetry reading.
Oh, I mean, my God.
Oh,
wow.
It's fucked. But you know,
I've got an album by a guy. I'm giving it away, but because I've been going through, I'm listening to a comedy album a day, or trying to the whole year, right? And I've got a guy who's from Michigan, used to be on a children's show, and you wouldn't know that from side one of the album. Just racist, queers this, queers that. Does he mean any of it? Probably not, but that's the only kind of joke he knows how to tell. And then side two is kind of beautiful singing. Like, he's kind of a really good singer.
Oh, I gotta see this one.
Yeah, it's
Let's see if I know it.
At least in comparison to the comedy. I think it's all, like, it's a huge palate cleanser. It's like, you kind of think he's the greatest thing on the planet because I just got through listening to that garbage. So, yeah, these things are so... But I don't understand. The two halves of your personality a record, I don't quite get.
It's awful, too, because I think that kind of, like, you know, homophobic type of material was just so common, and I don't think the people necessarily even feel that way. That's just the way that, I mean, I just remember when I was a kid at school, we would say these kind of things all the time.
And I'm
kind of horrified, really, that this was like the way that we would talk, because it was just, you know, especially when you're a kid, you're just terrified of being beaten up or of being perceived as weak or whatever. I don't know, sometimes I feel sorry for these guys that committed this crap to vinyl.
Yep.
You know, sometimes there's comedians I would never name, but on air, but there's guys that have good reputations, and I can tell from listening to just the way that they talk that, like, this guy really hates women. Like, mm-hmm. this guy's got a problem. This yeah. guy's got an actual problem with gays or mm-hmm. with women, mm-hmm. and people don't say that about them. But it's yeah. just like, why do you keep coming back to this? Or why is there this weird mm-hmm. sort of, like, authentic hatred that's creeping into all this shit that you're saying, you know? And then there's other guys where it's just somebody who's making cheap jokes.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the time that they were doing it it was fine to make
jokes. Dice is walking
that.
This weird line at the time where it was fine.
I know.
You know? Where it was fine, but he does clearly playing a fucking character. It doesn't matter if some of this does come from who he is. Most comedy does. Like,
it's kind of an extra level of ugliness.
It is. Yeah, 100%. But to know it's a character, to be admitting it's a character at the same time, yeah, that's why this is so complex of a record that you picked. And I might even have to re-listen to it. As much as it's a pain, it's going to pain me to do, I might have to.
I think it's underrated, although I, like I said, I think it's not for everyone.
Of course, anyway, of course.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's weird when you're doing characters. You know, I think that the character of Neil Hamburger has changed over the years in different ways because you want to keep it interesting sure. for yourself. And, you know, you change also. And it's like, I made so many records and done so many things that way that if I was still making that first record or following that path over and over again, it would be a total nightmare. So I'm glad, you know, that it's gone in these different directions. And one of the major changes was becoming an actual live persona.
Yeah.
You know, or we did this movie, Entertainment. Yeah. That, I mean, the character of Neil Hamburger in that, although never identified as Neil Hamburger, is more similar to the one on the initial 1996 Neil Hamburger album than it is to the current
okay.
version of Neil Hamburger. Yeah. You know what I mean? But with Dice, it's weird. I almost wonder if he, over the years, has started to take that persona and carry it with him into the public eye a little bit more than mm-hmm. he intended. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a safety blanket, you know what
I mean?
I guess.
Yeah, because, I mean, he was Andrew Clay, and he was a guy that you see him in sitcoms playing, like, yeah. kind of harmless characters, even, like, nerd characters and, mm-hmm. you know, like, kind of Fonzie-type guys, but not with the edge and this sort of thing. And
yeah.
romantic leads and all kinds of sorts of things, right. you know? And when he right. wasn't doing the Dice thing, that's kind of more who he was. And now you see him out in the public and he's a lot more like Dice, you sure. know? Although, you know, from everything I hear, he's like he's like the world's greatest dad and like a good family man and sweet guy is what I always hear.
I've never heard anything bad about the guy. I mm-hmm. mean, the way you can, I, you know, I'll let that speak for it. You know, I think that's good.
Yeah, look what you hear about Bill Cosby and look what you hear about Dice, you know, yep. and then compare the acts.
Yep,
you know?
yep. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Got to tell you, we had an episode ready of the podcast right before all that shit came out. And it's like, how do I release this now? I did with a long caveat at the beginning.
Who was talking about?
Actually, it was an archaeologist mm-hmm. in San Francisco area who used a Cosby album and a bunch of other albums as evidence. There was this hippie commune that burned down and it's now a state park. And he used them as kind of like they're part of the archaeological strata. That and there was one comedy album and they were like, fuck it, let's talk to him about, you know, archaeology for mm-hmm. now. And it was a weird discussion, but it was actually really great and fascinating.
Sounds great.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun, but we had to talk about Cosby. And then unfortunately I waited 5 months to release the fucking thing, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay, I don't have another episode to release, so here we go.
What's how much pleasure have you gotten out of the Cosby records? Would you say you're a fan of those records?
I can't really say that anymore. Yes, I absolutely love them. They're not influential on me as a comedian, but I'm like, these are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I would say they're arguably perfect and mm-hmm. sweet and kind.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just like, I can't deny that they were that to me. But yeah. at this point, I absolutely can't. No.
And there's a weird one with a Spanish Fly track. And yep. there's so many hints.
Oh, yeah. 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 Little like bits and pieces are like, oh, fuck, really? Oh, I don't, you know, yeah. It's.
Did you ever see a movie that Cosby made or was in with Harvey Keitel called Mother Jugs and Speed?
I've never seen
Raquel
it.
Welch.
I only know of it. I've never seen it.
God, it's great. Yeah. It's very, very weird.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I grew up with it's a weird black comedy, but it's yeah. actually like it's kind of shocking to me, like what a foul kind of movie it is.
Okay.
In a way, it's it makes more sense that... I remember when I saw it, which was in the theaters when I was 10, mm-hmm. I kind of couldn't believe, like, whoa, what's Cosby doing in this movie?
Yeah,
it's,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
just these unsavory characters and situations and things. Okay. Anyway, I hardly ever talk to anyone that's seen the movie, but I really like it. I think mm-hmm. it's like there's a certain type of weird black comedy from the 70s. It's just Fire Sale is another one that okay. Alan Arkin made.
I have not seen that either.
Just another just really dark, kind of mm-hmm. unpleasant comedies that that flopped. But
yeah, I do like that this is an aesthetic that you appreciate like so deeply. Is mm-hmm. there are there some comedy albums that we might not have touched on that have like, well, influence or not, but like that you might have loved growing up or something you've discovered that maybe people aren't aware of? Because I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact of your actual obsession with vinyl in terms mm-hmm. of how much you have and how much of it is in this book over here. But
you know, it's weird. There aren't a lot of comedy records that I really love, mm-hmm. you know, but there are a lot of records that I listen to for comedic value.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it was either unintentional comedy or it was people that were incorporating comedy into what they were doing. Like, for instance, I really love Leonard Cohen,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's a guy with a very good sense of humor.
Yeah.
And it's like you're going to get a really serious song, but there's going to be one line in there that's, to me, funnier than anything you're going to find anywhere.
Sure.
And there's a lot of music like that I find would probably be more inspiring to me as comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you, like I say, when you can work it into a serious song, you know?
Yeah.
I really like the records that Tim makes, Tim Heidecker, where they're, it's not like his music records, they're not like what people expect from him.
Sure.
And they're not comedy records.
Mm.
But then when there's one line in there that's comedic, it's such high quality comedic writing that,
yeah.
you know, I mean, he really likes Randy Newman. That's a good example of yeah. somebody like that, where it's just this sardonic, like it's,
oh, yeah.
I like that kind of stuff a lot. I mean, the comedy records that I really wore out were really the Steve Martin and the Albert Brooks records.
Sure.
And then, you know, I liked some Richard Pryor records. Never enjoyed the George Carlin records for whatever reason.
Okay.
Just couldn't get into it. I just didn't, I just wasn't a big comedy record guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Well, I mean,
sorry.
How dare you?
I tried a lot of them, but I mean, you know, I'm sure you know, a lot of them don't date very well. And
most of them are shit. I mean, yeah. I've listened to, I'm on like, I should be on 110 or something. I'm on like 85 this year. Not revisiting much. So they're mostly shit. Even the big ones, you know.
Rock Rotten Rule is one that I could never get. It. Sharpling and Worcester.
Oh, okay.
The first thing that they did, mm. Rock Rotten Rule. I think that's one of the greatest comedy records.
I
of
should
all
probably
time.
Listen to
oh,
it.
It's
something I need to catch up
sensational.
On.
It's sensational. Yeah, most of them are shit. Did you ever read the Goldmine Record Guide?
I have it. I've read through it.
That the guy that wrote that is crazy, and like the book is really it's fucked. It's really weird.
Yeah,
it's got some strange things to say, and
mm-hmm.
where he takes whole artists, you know, and just gives them all one. I mean, it's like he hates these records.
Oh yeah, he hates Firesign Theater.
Yeah, he hates them.
Yep.
Red Fox. There's like so many things that he just hates, and I kind of get it. In that most comedy records don't hold up, but this guy's got bad taste. Additionally,
yeah.
I think the Albert Brooks records maybe get one star each. You know?
That's interesting to me.
And then he's just so stupid and lazy. Like he reviewed my prank call record, Great Phone Calls,
uh-huh.
which I think I had this book for a couple of years before I noticed that it was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So when we put that record out on the label itself, it came out on vinyl originally.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to put my name on it. And so I put compiled by ! And ! Just, you know.
All right.
My friend Becky Wilson, she helped me put the thing together and did a couple voices on the record as well. So compiled by ! And ! And then the record says Great Phone Calls on the cover and on the spine and mm-hmm. on the label, and no artist is credited. So the guy who wrote that Goldmine book, he has it in there. And I think it gets a black square, the worst rating you can get.
No.
But he credits it to ? Like spelled out ? So it's in the Q's. ? Is the artist.
Oh my God.
And like, this is from like 7-point type on the label, compiled by question mark and exclamation point.
That's
right. Not spelled out.
Right.
So it's like question mark, great phone calls. And then the review is something like, you know, this question mark, whoever he is not to be confused with question mark of question mark and the Mysterians, the 60s.
That was my first
pop group, you know? Well, yeah, no, of course it's not to be confused, right. Imbecile.
Yeah.
You know, and then he's just like, yeah, this is not funny.
Wow.
That's essentially the review. It's like mostly about question mark and the like, what the hell? Like, seems... that book is funnier than most of the comedy records that were made. But yeah. And also, like, he's got every Red Fox record and all those Richard Pryor records that came out on Laugh Records and all this kind of sketch. Mm. He's got all those things with one black square for all of them. He didn't listen to them.
No.
He didn't listen to them.
Red Fox released... They're not all the same. Many. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them are the same.
I mean, if you have a I haven't listened to this one yet, because this is the one I've just got... I'm never going to buy them all, obviously, right? But if you listen to his first, it's nothing like Red Fox. It's not the Red Fox which is kind of the adventure that I like in listening to these old ones. Even if they're not great, I like knowing what somebody sounded like the first time they're committed
That's
to vinyl.
That's what I say about Neil Hamburger, too. When people say, why did you change the voice? It's like, I've had a long career with this shit. It's going to naturally change. Like, any George Carlin's first records don't sound
at all
like the other ones. So why shouldn't mine sound different, too?
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And I was wondering, too, because as I was trying to, like, listen through and see if I could hear an obvious progression, but I like that it happened. I like that it's more natural. That's a nice way to do it.
It's better because I don't know. You just want to do things intuitively and not plot it all out too carefully.
Of course.
What are your favorite comedy records? Like, top three?
They're going to end up being so super pedestrian, though. Yeah, I mean, they're on the wall. I think they're on the wall because Class Clown is one of my favorites by George Carlin. Mm-hmm. I really genuinely love Let's Get Small, Smothers Brothers of the Purple Onion. I do love all of most of Weird Al's stuff I would put up in the top. I love Cheech and Chong simply for the production value. I actually don't necessarily... They influence me, but mostly it's like, I want to make an album sound this good.
Lou Adler, I mean...
Right?
Of course it's going to be better. I mean...
Right.
They got a real producer.
What I didn't know is how many of the actual sound effects Cheech and Chong recorded themselves.
Oh, really?
I interviewed Tommy Chong the other day, and which was kind of amazing. It was by phone. But he's like, yeah, well, you know, we went out and we just drove into a drive-thru and did all this shit. I was like, that's kind of awesome. I had no idea that they had that.
And you know why? It's because you can't get good sound effects. When I did the first 4 or 5 Neil Hamburger records were not... there was no live act.
Yeah.
And I was doing the same thing. I was going and getting my own sound effects because I was buying these high-end CDs from... Not, you know, you can buy the ones at Tower Records or whatever for $9.99 that Elektra put out or whatever, but they sound really bad.
Yeah.
So I was buying these ones from these like Hollywood, supplying to television, like CDs would be like Applause and it's like $75, but I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be good Applause.
Oh no.
And then I'd listen to it and I'm like, this is worse.
It's garbage. Yeah.
And so, you know, I'd be clinking glasses together and going out to bars and trying to get all this shit. It's the only way to get the good sound effects.
Yeah.
You know? And you know what? Here's something that you might find interesting. I was doing all these Neil Hamburger records with the fake audiences, and it's really hard to get the good Applause when you need a big room.
Yeah.
Because
you've
taken them from comedy records, but usually there's part of the voice that cuts into it.
Yeah.
So I had this idea, and this would have worked so well. I would have had the greatest library of sound of laughter and applause.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to go to the Marcel Marceau show and record the whole show.
It's perfect. It's amazing. It'd be amazing.
And I was living in Australia. I was living in Melbourne, and fucking Marcel Marceau was doing a show there. And I was like, yes. And the funny thing was, it was all the tickets for Ticketmaster Australia all said no, cameras or sound recording equipment allowed. But for this, they specifically deleted the sound recording thing because they knew you can't hear anything. So they did it. I don't know if it was a joke or whatever, but it was like in an article about it. They're like,
this is amazing.
And I'm like, great, I'm going to bring my stuff and record this show. and then it turned out it was the day that I was getting married was the same.
Oh, shit.
So I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to go from the ceremony to this Marcel Marceau show. No. And then he was dead the next year.
Yeah. God, though, that would have been phenomenal.
Just a great, because it's like a 2-hour show.
Mm-hmm.
Would have had this incredible library.
Yeah. That was a gag. I love that. that was a gag I always thought was funny when I was a teenager, was making a Marcel Marceau album, but I do love the idea that you literally were going to use that. Oh, God, that's so perfect. That's amazing.
And it would have been unique, like yes, a unique yes. library. Fuck. And there's no more mimes.
No.
There's
no,
nobody no. who's going to fill their shoes.
Yeah. That are going to get anybody to laugh.
Have you heard the Marcel Marceau album that came out?
I have not. So somebody actually did do that. Okay.
I mean, I don't think they really... No, they didn't really do that. They did. They okay. just took they some did. Sound effects.
Right. Okay. So I was wondering. Okay.
There's a whole series of these bullshit records. There's like there's one called The Wit and Wisdom of Ronald Reagan, and you put the needle down, it's blank on both sides.
Solid. Okay. Gotcha. I'm actually kind of dreading getting into some of the... I mean, I don't have anything that's quite like that... I won't call it artsy, but that unusual and interesting. But I do have some like Reagan era political, like even I love Gary Trudeau and everything, but mm-hmm. I have the Rap Master Ronnie LP or EP, and I'm dreading listening to it because I just, it's those things that are of their time, like, to such an extreme.
Do you ever get into those break-in records, like the Dickie Goodman stuff?
Where is it? I just listened to Mr. Jaws for the first time and last time.
The album? Day.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole album. Oh, it's awful. I mean, it's worse than you would imagine.
Yeah. It's bad.
Yeah.
I thought those were really funny when I was a kid. The Dickie Goodman singles. I would get those singles for a dollar or whatever, but
why wouldn't you?
Have you read the book that Dickie Goodman's son wrote about him?
No.
You should check that out. It's on Amazon.
Holy shit.
It's called I think it's called The King of Comedy or something.
All right.
It is brutal.
Yeah.
Brutal. It's such a sad story.
Oh no.
I mean, the book opens with the son going to poor Dickie's house, his crummy apartment where he's just blown his brains out. And then he describes cleaning his father's brains out of the carpeting
Christ.
And, you know, and it just,
holy shit.
It's just a gruesome beginning. And it's just his career just really, I mean, of course, like, how are you going to, I mean, when you're a kid, you assume, wow, he made Mr. Jaws. He's a multimillionaire,
sure.
but
sure.
How are you going to pay the rent long term making those kinds of records? And mm-hmm. so, you know, he was doing all kinds of things to stay afloat, and finally couldn't take it anymore.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's,
well, I guess I should have his son on my podcast. That's the easiest way to have him get that story out. Although I don't want him telling that story on my fucking show.
Easiest way to get him to give you a free copy of the book too.
Oh my God.
Has anyone, nobody's ever wanted to discuss those on your show?
No. No. I'd be willing to do it. I'll talk about anything for a fucking hour, you know. I could break it down and probably find a way to appreciate it on some weird level, because I guess I'm way too open-minded. But
I love that Albert Brooks parody on.
Yes, me too. I mean, it's something I didn't appreciate until I listened to this properly. I'm like, oh yeah, that's solid. That's amazing.
Making up the fake songs.
Making up the songs is so good. Ah, oh, it's brilliant.
What are your favorite? I guess Fire Sign Theater, like staged sort of produced comedy records.
Yeah, I mean, it's still gonna be Cheech and Chong at the top again, just mm-hmm. for the production value.
Mm-hmm.
Firesign I'm getting into more because I'm friends with one of the guys from Firesign now, mm-hmm. and it's like, I didn't appreciate it. The only way to get to me to appreciate it, because it went way over my head as a kid, is to listen to this guy tell me about the making of the album. So it's kind of its own thing. Oh God, Cheech and Chong is just so brilliantly, honestly. And I don't really like the content. Adam Sandler's albums are really well produced.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I've never listened to
one. They sound great. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they're funny. I know mm-hmm. there are a lot of people who have wanted to talk about them on here. I won't let them do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That or the Jerky. Maybe the Jerky Boys ones. We haven't done it. But yeah, like those are just really
brilliantly produced.
You haven't
done the Jerky Boys?
No. And they did a vinyl album, so I can't reject it now. I really can't turn it down if I want to. But I mean, honestly, Firesign has the most just, I mean, to have the balls to do basically an entire track for, you know, 45 minutes, you know. Or, you know, they just completely run into one another.
The other thing, actually, when you're asking me, or maybe you weren't asking me, but I was just babbling. But the other records, the comedy records that I listened to a lot were the National Lampoon records when I was a kid.
See, this is the problem. Records. I always forget the National Lampoon records. There's one on the wall.
Yeah, I forgot it too until now. But like mm-hmm. that, especially, not that I just had the greatest hits, but the mm-hmm. National Lampoon greatest hits was so solid.
Mm-hmm.
So solid, you know.
Those are the most, I feel like those are the ones that I often forget because, again, the upsetting factor. I get kind of creeped out by them. Mm-hmm. I think they're great, but they creep the fuck out mm-hmm. of me. Oh, Credibility Gap. There's the other one. Credibility Gap.
Yeah,
also
yeah.
brilliant.
Yeah.
Maybe not their first album, but their other album. There is an album that most people haven't heard called Floats that they did, mm-hmm. which is this, it's half sketch and half them actually improvising a report during the Rose Bowl parade in 1970 or late 60s. And it's so good. Mm-hmm. It's really great. Listening to those guys improv is phenomenal. Phenomenal. So yeah, credibility gap's good. That'd be my,
are there any that you, really, really don't like? What's your all time bottom of the barrel comedy records?
Ooh, boy. Well, I can point you to that. It's mostly the independent shitty label ones. I'd have to dig through. I will tell you I'm
recent,
having
recent stuff or the private pressing.
I don't listen to enough recent comedy. Yeah. I'm really guilty of that because there's a lot of garbage. Usually the I honestly probably shouldn't say this. I love Patton Oswalt.
Mm-hmm.
Listened to his first album the other day. I don't really like it anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I think he would argue that, yeah, I'm a lot more open-minded now, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't say some of that shit on stage. So, again, super sensitive guy, but, like, if I'm gonna pick him apart, that would not be my favorite of his album. So I was kind of shocked that I didn't like it as much.
Yeah.
So I was sent, like, this giant pile of records.
You might love it 10 years from now, too.
There's a chance. There are a couple artists that I would gleefully shit on without the thing running, but, you know. Muslims, I just don't like them as people, and I think there's.
Oh, okay.
There's. I don't like them as people, and it comes across in their comedy.
Right.
Like, I'm like, oh, that's shitty comedy. Are they a bad person? Oh, it turns out they're also a shitty person.
Can't wait to talk about this off air.
Just one that stands out in particular. But if it turns out to be a friend of yours, then I'd be a real asshole. Eh, and, you know,
probably isn't. I would hope that I've weeded people that are that obviously rotten out of my life, but who knows?
So. Okay. So this album. This is, and I don't know if this will happen. We've only done a Dice one other time on the podcast, and it wasn't as in depth, I don't think, as we got.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him. I always ask, why would you recommend listening to this album as a first album to listen to for Dice? Can you do that? Do you think?
If you were just interested in exploring the artist,
let's say you don't. Well, number one, if you don't know him,
mm-hmm.
would you recommend listening to it? And then if not, would you recommend listening to him under some other circumstance?
I mean. I'm of the opinion that, you know, not everything's for everybody, and there's certainly people that even are my friends that ask about things that I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, yeah, you know, I don't think you're really gonna like it. Don't bother, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I think they their taste isn't good enough. It's sure. not snobbery. It's not that I think that the things I'm doing are terrible. It's just not a good match, you know. So. I would recommend the Dice strongly, and I have, to somebody that I thought would like it.
Yeah.
And I would not recommend it to somebody that I thought didn't, you know?
Well, I think we've
And I do recommend it to people. I actually I actually talk that record up a lot to people, and, you know, because people ask you, what did you listen to mm-hmm. when you were a kid or whatever? And I always bring that record up. But... if you were starting fresh and just wanted to know if you liked Dice or not, mm-hmm. maybe The Day the Laughter Died Part 2 would be a little bit easier.
Yeah, okay, okay.
But it's still not easy.
Is there some of the Dice character in that one?
It's just kind of a faster, it's just an angry, faster kind of record.
Okay.
It's maybe uglier.
Yeah, interesting. All right, that means I now have to listen to it. I can actually look as to when this is coming out, but let's assume several weeks from now. Mm-hmm. Is there anything coming up that you can want to promote, or where can people find your stuff?
In the dump.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The bottom of the dump in Whittier. The Whittier dump, along with all the old props from the 1978 Sgt. Pepper movie. I don't know. I guess in June... the new season of Decker, mm-hmm. Decker Unsealed, will be starting on Adult Swim June 4th.
Okay.
I think.
All right.
12 episodes. So if listening to somebody try to justify the Andrew Dice Clay album for an hour makes you want to watch something that they've done, there you go. There you have it. I got something for you.
That's perfect. I have only one other question about Neil Hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
Is his resting face pain? Because I can't quite tell. I was just trying to examine it way too hard. Or is it just a face you like doing that just seems to match the character? I can't tell if he's in pain, emotionally or otherwise.
Oh, I definitely think there's some emotional pain always.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's
Just the way you hold your mouth is just, it's so...
You know, it's weird, but it's like, it's really like the Superman Clark Kent thing where if you're gonna transition into somebody who's completely different without a bunch of prosthetics and wigs and mustaches and stuff, you've got to make it work using the muscles in your face. Yeah. And you know what I mean? So if I were to relax, it would look like me. So I've got to stay.
Makes
sense. I got to keep the face like that.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Perfectly reasonable response.
Hopefully one day it doesn't stick, but it may.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
This was a ton
of fun. Thanks for having good questions.
Oh, I hope they were okay. Well, thank you guys for listening. You can go to
YouTube. Assuming that they're listening.
Yeah, I hope to God. YouTube.com/comedyonvinyl. That's where you can see all the shit that I'm doing and the one album a day for the rest of the year. And go to stolendress.com for all my other stuff, books, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.